I'm Karen Given, and it's time for Three Stories You Should Know.
Jackson stops on a dime, slides past Van Noy, and is out of bounds.
Second-year Baltimore Ravens quarterback Lamar Jackson stole the show during last Sunday's victory over the Patriots, and that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by the Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman and by Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks so much, Karen.
Thanks, Karen. Good to be here.
All right, Ken, take it away.
Well, your first mention is really what I've been focused on this week, this whole Lamar Jackson, Tom Brady moment. And bigger than that, where are we in terms of the black quarterback? Many people have pointed out this is the 50th anniversary of James Shaq Harris being drafted into the National Football League in 1969, and he became the first prominent black quarterback in the National Football League. And, you know, what does that mean? Where are we now? And if you think about when Lamar Jackson was drafted, some of the same conversations were taking place back then were taking place with him, a dual-threat quarterback. You know, not so much the race issue as it was back then, but all the coded language there. Mm-hmm. So to see Jackson beat the GOAT, Tom Brady, kind of brought it all to a head and gave us another moment to reflect on what it means, but also the conversation that's still taking place about athleticism versus thinking quarterback or just a great quarterback without all the qualifiers that come into play. If James Shaq Harris was kind of 1.0 and we had a period of time where it was 2.0, where there just weren't that many. Mm-hmm. Now, this season, we have the largest number of black quarterbacks that we've had since 2013, and we're tied for that number. Are we in kind of a 3.0 moment? And how do we get to 4.0 where we don't have the conversation at all? Or we can have the Jackson versus Brady duel, and it is just these two great quarterbacks, and look at these two different styles, and not take it much further than that.
Rachel?
Well, I don't think we're quite beyond this issue yet, unfortunately. And I think that's because there's a larger issue in the NFL with a lack of representation among all levels of leadership. Mm. I think only two head coaches in the NFL this year are African-American, which is continually shocking. I often think in the context of this conversation about Warren Moon, who, of course, was not drafted, but ends up in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And this is not ancient history. He played in the year 2000. I think that we still are in a place where, you know, progress is not linear. It's not always just up and up and up and better. And I hope, Ken, to your point, that this is a 2.0 or 3.0 in terms of black quarterbacks and that we'll continue to see progress because they're not totally representative of the makeup of the league, and they should be.
So before the 2018 draft, Bill Polian, he's a Hall of Fame GM, suggested that Lamar Jackson would be better off as a wide receiver. And right. Polian just didn't think Jackson had the size to be quarterback because he's 6'3", 211. And everyone knows the ideal quarterback is at least 6'4", 220. I mean, come on. That's crazy. And one of the really cool things that happened this week is that Polian came out and said, I was wrong. And I always think of this, the NFL really obsesses over these little differences in height, in weight. And I think sometimes those distinctions are just an excuse for the distinctions that nobody wants to say out loud. And I think it's great that this is changing. Lamar Jackson has 637 yards rushing through the first eight games of this season. Tom Brady has rushed for just over 1,000 yards in his entire career. Like, this is his 20th season. But I was reading Lonnie O'Neill's piece in The Undefeated, and she quotes a historian who says of black quarterbacks, they are the next generation of civil rights workers because in some ways they're risking their bodies to change a country. And I think about all the damage done by rushing, and that quote just really punches me in the stomach.
I read that quote as well, and I think about that kind of analogy, you know, in the same pantheon as, you know, Bill Roden with his $40 million slaves kind of analogy. It just strikes me as a little bit too far to take it. You know, Rachel said something that's very important in terms of how these things change. And what we can't forget is Ozzie Newsome, an African-American man, one of the few African-American general managers, was in the draft room when Lamar Jackson was drafted. So it is, just like corporate America, just like the rest of the world, the more inclusive and diverse these rooms are, the easier it will be to make decisions based on merit without any reference or any lingering thoughts of whatever someone's personal bias may be.
That sounds like a good thing. So on Monday, The Athletic dropped a report suggesting that the LA Chargers, formerly of San Diego, were considering a move to London. To be fair, the report only said that the Chargers, quote, would at least listen if the NFL approached them about London. Now, since the report dropped, Chargers owner Dean Spanos has fired back with the following rebuttal. It's total, this is our home, and this is where we are planning to be for a long time, period. He might be just protesting a bit too much there. Despite the protestations, and the NFL has denied the report too, I think the Chargers in London sounds like a pretty good idea. I mean, this two teams in LA thing is a failed experiment, and London has got to be better than selling 90% of your tickets to fans for the away team. Ken, am I right on this one?
Well, you're right about the idea of how we're going to make a league global.
Mm.
There's a famous story that one of the leagues that were playing overseas early on, that the fans were kind of watching, you know, mundanely as touchdowns were being scored. And then somebody kicked a field goal and they went crazy. Because they were the idea of, you know, I think it was Barcelona, the idea of seeing a great kick. But I think we're beyond that. And I think the success that the various leagues have had in London does bode well for that as a possibility. I still, you know, as we've looked at this over the years, it's still a problem of travel. Mm-hmm. And it's maybe if you get a team that's also in Paris, you know, maybe that's when it happens. But in terms of revenues, can we put the Chargers back in San Diego?
I'm all for it. Rachel?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, this is not a Chargers problem. This is an LA football problem. Mm. You know, the Rams have had problems, too, with attendance. It's tough in big urban areas, somewhat ironically, in California to draw to football games. And this is a longstanding problem. I mean, ask USC and UCLA. Los Angelinos, they are basically like, you know, show me the record before they're willing to show up and watch games in person.
I have a lot of family in Southern California. And it's also there are just generations of football fans in Southern California who are not fans of a team. They're fans of particular players. Hmm. They don't have the same affiliation when it comes to the teams. All right, Rachel, it's your turn.
Okay, well, last week, New Jersey Advanced Media reported on some troubling tactics by the softball coaches at Rutgers. In one instance from the story, after Rutgers players went $6 over their food travel budget on a road trip, they were told to run 6 100-yard sprints each in less than 17 seconds. Some players were left crying, doubled over in exhaustion. One player said she blacked out. This week, the Drake Group, a longtime critic of college sports, called for something interesting. They called for a prohibition of physical punishment of athletes. And they weren't talking about physical abuse, but using exercise as punishment. And the group actually drew a dotted line between the amped up workouts in the heat that preceded the death last year of a Maryland football player and post-practice sprints that coaches use as a penance pretty routinely. You know, experts say that using exercise as punishment at best teaches, you know, younger people to hate exercise and at worst puts them in physical danger. So I think a lot of us probably haven't even questioned this practice. But what do you two think of this? Is this something we should really consider, banning exercise as punishment?
Well, this show often allows me to bring up my sordid sports history. But I am a pre-water break athlete of the 70s. I'd never reflected on it in that way. I tend to try to stay in shape, but I do have a little attitude about exercise. And I wonder how much that really is something to be concerned about. You know, the idea of running wind sprints or doing something that gives you a moment to reflect is meaningful. But certainly in the examples of players dying and that sort of thing, that's an extreme.
I know there are people at home who are like, hey, my high school coach made me run wind sprints. And if it was good enough for me, it's good enough for those kids today. But, you know, like when I was in high school, I rode around in the back of a pickup truck. It didn't kill me, but I'm not going to say it was a good idea, right? Like we've learned. That said, this came up this week because of that report about the Rutgers softball team, right? Mm-hmm. And if the report is to be believed, and I'm not at all questioning it, the women on this team were being flat out abused by their coaches. And the fact that those coaches used exercise as punishment seems to me to just be a symptom of that abuse. So isn't it possible to use exercise as punishment for good and not for evil?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. I think in the modern sort of age of sports where teams have nutritionists and they're measuring vitamin D levels and they have these very precisely prescribed workouts so you don't, you know, run too much or lift too little, you know, it strikes me as just counterproductive to have a planned practice and then just tack on all these sprints. You know, I mean, that is going to affect an athlete's recovery, maybe his or her sleep, all these other things.
Yeah, when you think about it, back in my day when the coach gave wind sprints, it might have been part of the plan the whole time.
Maybe. They were just waiting for you to mess up, right?
Right. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman and Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Karen.
Thanks, Karen.